Hello and welcome to the Garage Series Live. We're coming to you live this week from Microsoft. My name is Jeremy Chapman.
And I'm Yoni Kirsch. So we're here today, Microsoft Campus in Redmond, Washington.
Right, we're live so anything can happen. We've got a lot of great stuff for today. We've got Paul Thurrott on the show.
We do, from WinSuperSite.
Great author, blogger, journalist, awesome all-around guy in terms of just IT evangelist.
That's right. We've got Jefferson Criddle and John Hoger from the Office Engineering team as well joining us.
But don't forget, we've also got a lot of early adopter customers. So we're going to have guests on the show from Sephora, from the Walsh Group, from HHP Berlin. And as is tradition with our Garage Series shows, we have our trivia challenge that we're going to have all of our guests partake in as part of this.
And we're actually doing a multi-question live trivia challenge this week, aren't we?
Yes, that's going to be fun. So we're up to episode six now,
right,
as part of the series. And if you haven't caught all the different episodes that we have, we've covered a lot of ground in the last five episodes at Microsoft.com/garage.
Yep, that's right. You've got all the past episodes there. You can go and review. We've gone through the differences between the MSI-based Office 2013 Pro Plus install and the Office 365 Pro Plus click-to-run install, right?
We've talked about telemetry. We've done a lot of fun installs. We did a race against the MSI
and
using that System Center Config Manager, Intune, all those different tools, Microsoft Deployment Toolkit.
In episode four, you interviewed Mark Rusinovich from your car, right?
Yes, exactly. One of both of our heroes. As we're driving to the garage, no less, I had to talk to Mark Rusinovich.
You didn't have time to interview him in the garage, so you just said, hey, come for the drive along and we'll just do
exactly,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So, but, you know, one of the cooler things that we've seen in the last five episodes, you actually pushed somebody out of an airplane.
Right. His name was Fully Sick, our professional stunt skydiver. We pushed him out of the airplane to see if he could do the click-to-run install before having to pull the parachute, right?
And that was pretty awesome. There's a lot more coming of that. So let's have a look at our clip of what's happened over the past five episodes.
You have email across all your devices on your phone and your PC. We really wanted to think about that experience and bring that to Office.
But of course, there are a lot of shared features that are the same between the two. Again, they're pretty much indiscernible for anybody that sees a click-to-run or an MSI-based install.
And we're off.
Whether you're using roaming settings or not, you still have complete control over your data.
You can see, you know, all of the information as to what files were opened, what add-ins were loaded, in what order.
Now we got speed.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I wasn't supposed to talk.
Some say if you cut him, he bleeds ones and zeros.
And every time Windows blue screens, he grows an inch.
He's called Mark Rusinovich.
Are you Jeff Aiken?
Yeah, in many ways, actually.
It's kind of chugging along. It's, you know, it's doing its normal thing.
10 or 15%.
Oh, yep.
There we go. Popped up a little bit more. Maybe it's going to catch up.
We'll see, I guess.
We are racing against four other install types.
It's not just the speed at getting the bits on the machine or installing Office. It's the whole end-to-end.
Right, Jeremy. So I think one of the big themes through the last few episodes has been trying to explain some of the misconceptions that we're hearing time and time again from customers, people out there in the industry, right?
Right. We're hearing a ton of misconceptions, both on the consumer side and on the IT pro and on the enterprise side, about how all this stuff works and what it looks like from an adoption perspective.
Right, absolutely. And I think that someone who understands these misconceptions better than most is our first guest.
I thought you were going to say Fully Sick, because he actually installed from the airplane without internet connectivity. So that was one of the first ones. But yes, Paul Thurrott, you know, professional expert on all things Windows and Office. He's going to join us today to actually talk about some of the things that he's experiencing as he talks to his readers and viewers.
We have some questions for you, sir.
Okay.
So the first one is true or false?
Oh, gee. Well, at least they're true or false. I get it. All right, go ahead.
Multiple choice.
Yes.
The choices are true and false.
Yes.
Internet connectivity, is it required to run Office 365 Pro Plus?
Of course not.
Right.
That would be nuts. It's encouraged.
It's encouraged.
You save to SkyDrive by default, but of course you don't have to.
True or false?
Yes.
You need to uninstall previous versions of Office before you can install Office 365 Pro Plus.
Can I get a lifeline on this one?
Yes, you can. Okay.
All right.
Files and applications.
Oh, boy.
This, I should say, true or false.
Yeah.
Files and applications are now linked to the end user instead of being licensed to the device.
You said there'd be beer at the end of this. Is there beer?
Well, okay. No, it's kind of a gentlemanly handshake. Really,
okay. Okay. 305 episodes of Windows Weekly on This Week in Tech, the network, twit.tv, and you think I haven't learned a thing? Well, you're right, but I've gotten very good at solitaire during the show, so that's the
right.
That's what.
But
I've
also learned enterprise terms like Hadoop and Office 365.
So, Hadoop!
You know. All right, great. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you. My pleasure. And hello to everybody in the garage. I hope someday they give you an actual office. That'd be nice.
So welcome, Paul Thurrott. Wow, what are you
hello
wearing?
Again. Hello, sir. Well, good morning, citizens, again. When I think of the Garage Series, I think of two things. I think of all the awesome technology in Office, Click to Run, and so forth, and I think of skydiving. And I assumed, because there's been so much of it, that we'd be doing a little... No.
We've got the plane waiting outside for you.
Exactly. So you came straight from Boston right to Skydive Snohomish to fly right into the show. So thanks for joining us.
What are the handles for on your arms? Do you know that?
Those are so I can fly.
Right.
Nice. I'm going to fly on out of here when we're done.
Nice.
So you hear a lot of misconceptions. You're talking to your audience, mm-hmm. you know, pretty much every day through your blog and through all the stuff that you do with mm-hmm. Windows Weekly. What are you hearing, I guess, from people that are using the new Office and really weighing their options?
Well, I mean, the people using the new Office love it, but I mean, the people who are evaluating it have questions, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we are in this big transition period from on-prem, I think I own the software, to it's delivered from the cloud, and there's a little bit of confusion around ownership and what the value proposition is and so forth. And so for people like me, actually, that's great. It gives me a lot of content to write about and so forth.
Yeah, so you've actually made the decision, right, in your house mm-hmm. to go for Office 365 on premium. Tell us about that versus kind of the perpetual licensing.
That was a no-brainer. I mean, it was instant. When you think about five licenses in a household, I've got a wife, two kids, we all use Office. It just makes so much sense financially. It's not even a contest.
So I think a lot of that then would probably translate in a corporate environment where I've got a couple of devices, maybe two or three per mm-hmm. user, and they've got to have Office on all those different devices. So that's a lot of what we're hearing as well in terms of, you know, how we can make it a more user-based thing. In terms of like the older versus the newer, you know, I was watching your show with Leo and watching Windows Weekly. You know, and a lot of people are thinking, well, what's the difference between Office 2003 or 7 or 2010? What do I get for doing the new one?
Sure. Well, I mean, everyone's needs vary, obviously. I'm sure there are some people who get along fine with Office 2003, and God love those people. But, you know, Microsoft, obviously, you folks obviously improve this product as time goes on. I know it's for myself as a professional writer and for other people that need Office, that those improvements actually make sense. And one of the things that you don't get when you stick with an older version of Office is those ongoing steady improvements. And, you know, going back in time for me personally, I can't use an older version of Office, just like I can't use the versions of Windows that would have been new at that time.
Right. And, of course, we're going to go a lot deeper into all the different topics around the new Office, what's new, what's changed. You know, I wanted to cover one other misconception that people are asking. Is there really a garage at Microsoft? And you can answer that.
You're right. Myth busted. Yes, there is a garage. And I've been there and I've seen it. And there's remote controls for the doors and all that kind of stuff. And it's unfortunate in a way that we couldn't be there today. In the actual garage, but we're here, obviously, for the professional facilities. Yeah.
So let's roll the clip.
Imagine if you got to create something and never get to show it to anyone. How tragic that would be. You get to see it, and it's awesome. The garage is the place where you actually get to show it to people, and you get to get their help, too.
The culture of the garage is a core part of Microsoft that's been there for a long time, and it's really about grassroots innovation. In doing a garage project, you take something that doesn't exist and is completely ambiguous, and then through your actions and your passion and your learning, you make it real. We can have a debate all day till we're blue in the face about what will work and what doesn't, but it's that one guy in the garage that goes and builds it that proves whether it's a great idea or whether it wouldn't work out. I also look for ways where we can help more garage projects enter into both the systems that we use internally and our products. The ultimate thrill, I think, of building a garage project is when you look at a Microsoft product and say, my idea's in there, and it's going out to impact the world.
Mm-hmm. So remember, everybody, we're live today. We've got live questions and answers that you can ask our panel that we have waiting in the wings. So I'm joined with quite a few different people. We've got Yoni now at the back at the PPI.
That's right, Jeremy. So I'm hanging out in my corner here. I've got all of my gadgets set up and, of course, my enormous PPI display to explain any concepts or do a few live demos for everyone out there today.
Always at the ready. Paul Thurrett now seated to my left. And also to my left, I've got Patrick Wirtz from the Walsh Group coming to join us. Thank you for being here, Patrick. John Hoger from our Office engineering team, involved in the test of Office Wave 15. On my right-hand side, I have Sebastian Stein from HHP Berlin, Marvin Coria from the Sephora Group, and Jefferson Criddle from the engineering team for Office, who built a lot of that setup and click-to-run technology. So what I want to do is really ask about kind of what your guys' work environments look like these days. You know, if you compare it to, say, 5 years ago, where it might have been one device per user, how has that changed? So why don't you go ahead and kick that off, Patrick? How does that look for the Walsh Group?
You know, we used to have, like, it was that project manager, guys in the office type of scenario where there was one guy per device. Now we've got, I mean, it's really the guys in the field that are even really driving it. They're using all that bring your own device technology, multiple devices. I mean, and really the goal for construction is being out in the field. So it's really kind of conducive to the way we work. So it's been a monumental shift from 5 years ago.
Wow. In terms of maybe Sephora on your side, how does that look?
Wow. So, it changed for us. So we had a lot of, we had desktop environment 5 years ago, and then we changed it up to laptops, tablets, and phones. So we were issuing at least 3 devices to users on a daily basis.
Wow. And on the HHP Berlin side, I know you've got a lot of seasonal workers and things. How does that look on your side,
Sebastian? Yeah, we have an average of 2.5 devices per user, and yeah, the user are demanding to be able to work everywhere where they are. They want to actually work at home, which is kind of funny, but they demand it, so we have
sense.
To deal with that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And from the engineering perspective, I mean, how does this influence kind of what you guys are building, Jefferson? What was the thought behind in terms of getting that facilitated through the product?
Sure. So it's recognizing, as our customers here have stated, that the environment has changed. It's not locked to the desktop. The PCs themselves have changed. Sure, there's still desktops, but there's laptops, tablets, other form factors as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, mobile phones. We want people to be able to be productive wherever they are. Mm-hmm. And so we've had that in our minds as we've been designing our new features. And we want to say, hey, you know, it's not just desktop PC anymore. Yeah. We have a great Office solution that covers all the modern needs today.
Sure, and we're present on mobile devices and browsers, on full PCs, you know, Windows RT. John, I mean, from a test perspective, this is something that you're doing a lot of work with.
Yeah.
How's that all work out?
Yeah, you know, we really looked at it and saying, you know, you said it's 2.5-3 devices per user. Mm-hmm. And that's providing a licensing model that goes across PCs and Macs, the home use program, and allowing people to use it on the machines at home. So being able to scale that out and really focus on providing end users with the ability to use Office across all their devices.
Right, and one of the unique things with Office, well, not always unique with Office, but people are coming from multiple different versions. So I know a lot of people are coming from, say, Office 2003, Office 2010, Office 2007. What versions of Office are you guys coming from? So Patrick, why don't you start?
I'm sure there's a couple of 2007s out there sneaking around, but predominantly we're 2010. We really, every tick there's a talk type of thing. Every iteration we move to the next one. So that's where we're coming from, that 2010 environment.
Right. How about on HHP's side?
Yeah, we are trying to stay current, and actually the users, they are demanding the newest Office version. So we're coming from 2010, so.
Your users are amazing.
They are. Right. Engineers, that's how they are. Yeah. I guess it's the same at Microsoft, so.
And from the Sephora end, did you have 2010 as well?
No, we're on 2007, so okay. we're skipping that level in 2010 and going right to 2013.
Great, so one question I get a lot, I know you probably get it a lot too, is should I stay on Windows 7? Should I go to a more touch-friendly, kind of tablet-friendly environment with Windows 8 when I'm looking at Office? So
the answer is yes.
Definitely, you want to have the newest stuff across the board. But of course, there's still a lot of Windows 7 people out there. A lot of people just got done deploying it. So why don't you walk through that a little bit from your side, Patrick?
Sure. I mean, Windows 8 and Office 2013 are kind of matched hand in hand. I mean, the touch experience and all that is really where it's made it be. But that being said, the impetus for us is more getting those guys in the field with that touch experience, because those are ones walking the job site, having that type of scenario. But from a you know, should we hold off on 2013 for our, you know, users using Windows 7 or should before upgrading to 8? You know, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to try and do that at the same time. So 2013 on Windows 7, you know, with the extra features like having the import a PDF, our marketing department thought that was fantastic. So, right. I mean, there's a lot of great features that just make from a normal desktop Windows 7 environment as well for us.
Sure. So in terms of Windows 7 versus Windows 8, I know you guys are always kind of trying to do the latest stuff. So HHP's perspective on that?
We are rolling out Windows 8 if the user has a touch-capable device. We wait until the user has that, which we provide the touch-capable device, but we can't do all at once. So we do enrolling, upgrade of the hardware, and with that upgrade of the hardware, we also upgrade to Windows 8. So.
Right. I know on the Sephora side, you've got a lot of sales staff and people that, you know, would not have a desk kind of by definition of their role. So how does it work for you in terms of Windows 7 versus Windows 8?
Yeah, we're looking at Windows 8. And so what we like is the touch interfaces. Obviously, stacking Office on top of that makes it really good opportunity for us to sell some of the things that we're trying to do for our clients. Read mode, to your point, I love edit PDFs and, yeah. and whatnot. I mean, those are top-selling features for us. So, you know, when you look at read mode and you're trying to view something on a Windows device, I mean, it's great to be able to view it almost like a Kindle.
Right. So we're hearing a lot about touch, and that we've done a lot of enhancements around Office and where you can consume Office through the web, through the modern apps in Windows 8, through the native clients and the PC. Yoni's going to show us a quick demo on touch in the new Office. Go ahead, Yoni.
Thanks, Jeremy. So just to articulate the point that everyone was just talking to, what I have here is Word 2010 open. And you'll notice that I actually have Word 2013 open side by side as well, courtesy to Click to Run install. And what you can see here is that this software really is engineered to be used with the precision of a mouse. You know, I can move through the menus very easily. I can scroll with the wheel, and I can select the settings that I need to pick. However, when I start trying to operate this as a touch device, very quickly we discover that my fingers are a little bit too fat to navigate around. And you'll find that the same is true in 2013 as well. I have this same challenge where, you know, I struggle to get my finger in there.
If you're in mouse and keyboard mode.
Right, exactly. So right up until we hit this touch mode button right here, and you'll see what happened is the whole user interface is kind of expanded out. There's much bigger gaps between all the buttons, which means that I can very easily select what I'm trying to do. The drop downs have much wider arrows on them. And everything has a really nice high fidelity touch look and feel to it. And what you'll find is that if you're working on a touch device, maybe you're sitting in an airport lounge or whatever it is, then disregarding the touchpad and typing, but then using touch to navigate around the application becomes very natural. And of course, that extends over into the other applications such as Outlook, and we can see here that there's really a whole bunch of the user interfaces kind of been shrunk down and to let us focus on the content that's actually in our emails here. So if this was, say, a tablet form factor device, we've got these nice thumb buttons that I can do replies, deletes, or, you know, even scroll through my different folders here at the same time. Of course, that experience isn't limited just to the full Outlook application. We have a really fantastic experience in the web app as well. You can see this is the full web app client, and that's been optimized for touch as well. Now, this is the one that you might use on a touch-enabled laptop device. What if you're on a tablet device, Jeremy?
Yeah, and you might not even have, for example, the full clients installed, right?
Right, you might not have the full Outlook client. So say you're on a Surface IT and you wanted the Outlook experience. Here's another view that we have of the Outlook web app that's totally optimized for touch. You can see nice big buttons. We can go back to our main view and pull up our calendar. Once again, the calendar is nicely zoomed in and out for week view or month view or whatever that is. So there you have it.
Right. And then we also have the ability, if we've got to say a smaller, taller screen, like a phone or something, to actually have the device or the Outlook web app experience tailored to that device as well. So why don't you go ahead and take us through that, Yoni?
Yeah, so what I have here would be the equivalent of, say, a phone device, and this of course works on the Windows platform, also works on iOS. So if you wanted to get at your Outlook mail account from that web app, you can see that we've got a nice touch-enabled application there, and it has the same look and feel as the other ones. We can go through our contact list, calendar, and mail as well. But of course, what a touch demo would
is
be complete
without OneNote.
Without OneNote, right? So what I have is I have the OneNote application running here, and if I select some text here, you'll see that these radial menus pop out, and these are really awesome. Just using the touch interface, I can change the size of the text there, and you know, or even the color. I can select that I'm looking for reds, and then pick that I want that to be the color. At the same time, I have the opportunity to use the other hardware and the device. So say, for example, here we go. I can take a picture of the guy sitting on the couch there.
Great picture.
And I'm happy with that. And then that's right there into Outlook. So there you have it.
Awesome. Thank you, Yoni. So another big change, and kind of one of the crux of the new release, and we've talked about this a bit, Paul, is really this user-based licensing approach and following the user, whether you're talking about roaming settings or, you know, 5 activations per user. How was the transition? I mean, you at home, Paul, how was the transition for you?
Actually, the way I think of this is, for all the technology in Office, this is almost the most innovative thing in the new Office, right? Is this user-based licensing model. It's huge. I mean, this is the difference between Office locked to a device that is never leaving that device, essentially, versus Office coming with you, and coming with you with multiple licenses. It's amazing.
Right. So, Patrick, how was it for your end?
I mean, for us, it's definitely a difference in how we kind of started off with, you know, lock that one device. You know, we look at it as, because you have so many devices now, it makes more sense from us from a financial aspect, but then also from kind of a PR aspect. And now all of a sudden we can say, you know, we do not actually give 5 devices to all of our users, believe it or not. So, you know, now they can go take that home, that license home, and actually be able to use it there and have the same experience that they have at work as well. So it's been great so far.
And kind of one of the secondary questions I get for that is really, like, if I do install on that home computer, does it have access to my data? So how do you think about data security?
You know what? I mean, your roaming settings kind of come into play with that. So, you know, what you see with some of your recent files and whatnot. But from a security aspect, you know, it's all about what you have access to on the device. It's not about whether it's actually on that piece of software. I mean, and if you end up leaving the company, you know, that license comes back into your pool. You're not then giving that to that one person for time and eternity. So it allows us with the control, but the flexibility at the same time to really give our users the most benefit.
Right. So in terms of building out the licensing service, Jefferson, you know, what was kind of the thought behind that versus using 5x5 keys and those types of things?
Sure. So as was mentioned, we're trying to break away from the older story where it's one user, one machine, one Office activation, mm-hmm. and that doesn't accurately represent how our customers need to use Office today. Right. And so we have our Office licensing service that manages, here's the user, here's how many installs they're allowed. We've opened it up so that you can install on your PCs, you can install on your Macs, that's okay. And there's the 5 desktop install limit, and that's not fixed either. As old hardware gets decommissioned and new hardware gets provisioned, that's okay, no problem. You install it on your new hardware, sign in, and you're good to go. And yes, I think it's perhaps a minor victory, but you don't have to mess with the product keys anymore. Those 25 character codes,
not a minor victory.
Letters and numbers.
Exactly.
Like, you have to remember your sign in, and hopefully you remember that. But none of this products and letters, and hoping you get it right.
Right. We've got a live question actually coming in, I'm hearing. Somebody's asking, how do I do like an install of Office without installing the entire suite? And how do I save that precious disk footprint if I've got, say, a solid state drive? And I think Yoni's probably the best person to explain that because he's right next to the PPI and he can diagram that out for us. So go ahead, Yoni.
So you're saying the question was,
it was around
solid state drives, we don't have enough space, you know, we want to remove a couple of applications out of the suite.
We want to save disk space
because and how can we do that? Given that the click to run based install, you don't have the opportunity to say not install access or InfoPath or one of those components.
Correct, but let's break down kind of what the different components are.
Right. Okay. Sizes. So to start off with, let's have a look at how an MSI based install works. So an MSI based install, we do that on a machine. The total data footprint on that SSD in this case would be about
2.95 gig. Is that right, Jeremy?
For a professional plus, yes.
Right. 2.95. And in terms of how that actually breaks down, let's think about how to draw this up. At the bottom of it all, you have the MSO cache. And in there is going to be the install files of every component of Office, regardless of what you install, and that's to do repairs or add and remove components or whatever
else. That's been the same since 2007, about 650 megs or so.
Right, okay, so we have about 650 megs there. And then above that, the actual install of Office, we have the shared components. So this is the footprint on the disk that actually is for the parts of Office that are shared amongst everything, language stuff, dictionaries.
Yeah, we do a lot of things, obviously the grammar checking and spell checking, all that stuff. The common files, if you want to go into the file system, all that stuff. We're trying to share as much as possible to actually save footprint with Office with all the apps.
And that's probably going to be, you know, more than a gigabyte in those shared components there. And then, of course, the rest of it is broken down by the individual applications. So, you know, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, whatever they might be. And each of those individual applications, if I'm correct, would only be maybe 50 to 100 megabytes, depending on, you know, obviously Word might be bigger than InfoPath.
That's fair, and Outlook's a bit bigger than that 50 to 100 meg, but you're probably going to keep Outlook.
So I guess the thing to consider there is that if I'm to say Access, why do I always choose Access? Why is it that...
I don't know. We always get these questions.
I used to get Access from the Access developer. Team. Hey, yeah. why are you guys singling us out?
Access is awesome, by the way.
Yeah. Access is great, but perhaps in this case we want to take Access out of the equation. Then all that we're realistically going to save here is maybe 100 megabytes, which still is going to leave us with a footprint here of, say, 2.85 gig.
Right, so if you actually take out Access, and I always also pick on InfoPath, once in a while I'll pick on Link just because they might have something else that they're using. But all those taken out is about
maybe they're using the Windows 8 Link app.
2.65 gigs, so you're only saving about 300 megs or something. Now, where it comes into play a little bit different is the click-to-run setup.
So. And this is the funny thing, right? So a click-to-run install, total footprint on the disk. Obviously, you don't have the MSO cache anymore because we're doing those updates, repairs, reinstalls, and everything from the content delivery network or whatever local source that you're running. So we take that out of the equation. The shared components obviously still exist in the click-to-run package on the disk, so they're there. And then all of these individual components exist. The funny thing is, how big does that end up being on the disk?
So click to run's about 2.2 gigs on the disk because we've offloaded repair and all those things to the CDN.
Which means that even if we were to say remove Access and remove InfoPath from this install,
The
click to run install still takes up less space on your SSD.
And if you
delete
MSO cache, then you can't necessarily do a repair if something goes awry. So I mean you're trading off things, but you're really not saving that much, I think, is the crux of all of this.
Absolutely.
So thanks for that, Yoni.
No problem.
So one of the things that we hear about a lot is basically when we talk about cloud and, you know, a lot of customers are doing some version of hosted desktops or something to get to an office experience, for example. A lot of people are using remote desktop services, what we used to call terminal services back in the day, what some people still call. So I know on the HHP side, Sebastian, you've done a lot of thoughts around kind of RDS delivered office experiences versus having them native. Why don't you tell us that?
Yeah, so in the past, with 2008 R2 as terminal server and Office 2010, it wasn't really touch-capable. I mean, we've seen that before in Yorni's demo, that it takes a little bit more to be touch-enabled, but only having an RDS session. So that's one reason why we didn't deliver via RDS. And the other reason is it is a very complex environment. If you want to deliver a high performance and a high quality remote desktop session to the user, depending on his connection, and we would need more human resources to actually operate and maintain such a high complex
environment. And you're a relatively small company with a very broad distributed set of employees. So how do I have the compute resources everywhere to make it a good experience?
We said we want to have the touch experience for the users with the new Office, and so we didn't even try to build RDS
because
we are afraid of the costs of human resources.
So architecturally, I know John, you probably speak to this. We kind of built for this native app experience that's connected to web services. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, we wanted the new office to be like a fluid, fast and fluid kind of experience. And so running an office on the device is going to provide you with the best experience. And also taking advantage of hardware acceleration as well, to whether that's in transitions in PowerPoint or charts in Excel.
Right, and some of the advantages that you'll see if you do use RDS is it's still more touch-friendly. So even if I'm remoting into an Office 2013 installation, I still can take advantage of the stuff that Yoni just showed. And some of the stuff that he didn't show that we could talk to would be like the performance enhancement around changing the rendering engines to make that a lot more responsive, all the different things we did to make Office 2013 just a better user experience.
Jeremy, the other consideration there is that if you're looking at doing that, then I think that you should certainly consider using Windows Server 2012 as your RDS platform, because then you get if you put the desktop experience pieces on, then you can get the better touch integration from that side of it as well.
Right. So how do you see that from the Wall Street perspective? Because you're on sites that may or may not have internet and all these things.
Well, we do have some interesting places we go, but I mean, for us, RDS, Citrix, all that kind of fun stuff it's like a secondary type of application. I mean, anytime we can go native, that's hands down the way we're going to go. But even to the point of, you know, back to that whole, a lot of what we're constantly trying to accomplish is get the guys in the field. They want to be in the field. And, you know, realistically, having, you know, if you're paving 14, 15 miles with a roadway, you're not going to have internet connectivity all the way along that route. Or going all the way up in an office building that's still under construction. So really having that offline capability was key for us, that really RDS just, it wasn't a good fit for how we would actually deploy it.
Right. So in terms of kind of adopting the new office, Marvin, I wanted to ask you, who did you target first kind of as part of your piloting experience for the new office apps?
So we identified the IT group as our pilot, and the reasons why we identified IT first was there's a lot of applications that we use that are that have integration with the older version of Office. So we wanted to make sure that the new version of Office could work well with those plugins. You know, some people have a lot of, you know, BPC, business continuity planning type of applications that drill down to Excel, also finance related add-ins. So that was our biggest concern, make sure that Office would work with our third-party applications that integrate with Office. And then from there, what we decided to do was, you know, how do we market to our users in a successful way to show them all the benefits of Office? And so what we did is we sat down with our education team, went through, built a course curriculum around training, and really delivered a, you know, 2-hour session around how to use the new features of Office.
Right. So what were some of those favorite features that you were seeing, I guess, from the user experience perspective? What were they really happy with?
One of the best features of the new Office is Flash Fill.
Okay.
I mean, that is an awesome feature. I mean, for Excel to predict exactly what you're going to do is a great tool. Whoever came up with that, thank you. Additionally, you know, you have editing of PDFs, as Patrick said. You have read mode, you have touch mode, a lot. Link, I mean, we looked at Link and we said, wow, you know, there's a lot of capabilities here around how we can collaborate with users. We have tablets at our stores, so we want to do video-to-video calling. We also want to do, you know, instant messaging with our stores to corporate and corporate to stores. So we're really opening it up, our environment, to be more collaborative and open with some of our users at our stores.
Right. We've done a lot of work recently, actually, to augment the Link functionality and really release new client applications for this. You probably have users that are on both Windows and non-Windows platforms. So what I want to do is spend a few minutes demonstrating what we can do now with the new Link. So go ahead and show us that, Yoni.
I thought you were going to flick that over to me. Just happens that I've got a whole bunch of Link clients standing here ready to go. So probably the most exciting change to Link in the last few weeks, as far as I'm concerned, is the release of the Link 2013 client for mobile devices. So we have a client out on Windows Phone and also on Android and iOS. And what I will do, probably the most exciting feature as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that we now have HD audio and video straight down to the mobile client over either 4G or Wi-Fi connection. And what you can do is you can see here, if I jump over onto my traditional Link client, that I can kick off a video call. And I'm going to call Sarah, who's over on my phone device that I have here. We'll give that a moment to connect. And here I am over the Wi-Fi, and we can see that Katie's calling, and I could answer that either with the audio or with the video. And Link's going to start up on my phone. And straight away, we've got the audio, and the video kicks in there as well, so we can see the guy sitting there in the audience. And for me, that's really exciting. The first time that I installed this, and I was driving along in my car, and all of a sudden, someone called me on Link, and I picked it up in my cradle with the video and said, wow, over 4G, I'm having a video conversation here, which kind of made me feel as though I hadn't left the office in the first place. So let me catch up on this now. How does that play in with a very common office scenario that we have in terms of meetings that go around? And what I've got here is a meeting request that I sent out earlier. And we can still join these meeting requests in the way that we're used to from the traditional Link application. We can do audio, we can turn on our video if we want to do that. And the same capabilities are there as we're there the whole time. If I jump back up on my phone here for a second and flick over, we can see that I have my calendar, and I can see that I have a Link meeting right here on my phone, and I can join straight from here. This is going to connect into the meeting, and we should any second see that Katie's also on the call, and there's Katie's video coming from the other camera on the other side of this. I can turn the camera on my phone here, and I can participate in this Link call right from my phone. But it doesn't end there. We also might have the scenario where users don't have Link installed on their machine. Maybe they're using a Mac. Maybe they're using a PC. Maybe they're a guest, someone that doesn't use Link in their organization that you want to invite to collaborate with you in a meeting. Let's just call this person Jeremy. Although I'm sure you have Link.
I just find it impressive. You've got three people joining the meeting from the same device, basically.
Well, this is actually happening on my phone. I'm just sharing the screen down the USB cable. But we can see straight away that I've got... Now, I'm not going to be able to turn the third video on because, like you say, too many. But what I do have here is the Link web app, the Link mobile app, and the Link full client, all participating in HD audio and video conferencing. Right there.
But of course, if you want to, you can also go into, say you've got a Windows RT device, you can go into Link Modern App.
Yeah, of
course.
Let's
say if you don't have Link installed and you want to do something beyond what's in the web app.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have the Modern UI app for Link as well. Really nicely touch enabled. We've got presence from all of our users. We could call, we could do all these same things. Of course, Sarah on our phone is in a call. But we could see, and if I flick over this for you, I'll actually show you. Oh, it's gone now. Doesn't matter.
But it's all working across all these different clients. So
yeah, I actually got the call coming through on the phone there.
Exactly. So we're at no shortage for Link clients. And the great thing is, so regardless of the experience that you have, whether it's just coming in through a browser, and it even works on OS X, that you can go in through a Mac and get to a Link experience.
One last thing on that, Jeremy. I just wanted to point out that something that I really love is the consistency of the experience with all the different Link apps. Just to articulate what I mean by that, if I pull up the traditional Link client here and I'm using my mouse, then I hover over the person, or I can just touch on the person's photo and I get those icons that I know what they are, IM, call, video. And the same is true if I'm... I'll just hang up this call. If I jump back to the main screen of Link on the phone, then we have exactly the same experience here with the people that we're talking to. We've got the same icons. We know how to work with it straight away. So.
And one of the great things that we have, in addition to all those Windows platform devices, is that we actually have Link clients on non-Windows platforms. So Link for the iPad, able to join and participate in calls and do instant messaging, all that stuff. iPhone as well, a tailored device specifically for that platform. And for Android phone users, we also have an experience for Android that's native to that platform. All these are really tailored to the device, to their UI standards, and what those devices can do. So pretty exciting stuff, and really available everywhere, wherever you might join a meeting from. So I wanted to shift over to out of kind of the user and different new, what's new in Office considerations, and really go into the IT side of things, because that's you know, it's where a lot of my heart lies in terms of my background, what Yoni and I do on a daily basis. I wanted to get through, you know, talk about all the common experiences around the learning curve and what you guys are experiencing to get the new Office out using Click to Run versus MSI. So why don't you start, Patrick, and talk about your learning curve?
Sure. I mean, it is a little bit different in the sense of now all of a sudden you have this command line executable to download all the bits. But then after that, I mean, it's more or less the same. And we deployed a VSCCM, created a package, uninstalled 2010 from any, I mean, we had a couple of computers out there that needed 2010 for some add-ins. But aside from that, ripped and replaced, just brought out the 2010, put on the 2013, and the user was off and running again. You know, it was really more just kind of engaging that department head or that job site and let them know, yes, we're going to be doing this. And to be honest, there was little to no resistance. I mean, especially when they found out, I mean, we keep on coming back to this PDF import, but that's such an easy sell for everybody. You kind of tell them that, and that's just sort of allows everybody to really work and keep on going from that that state that we already were in with just that small learning curve of the command line interface. Right.
So Marvin, how did you roll out to your end users?
So what we did is, you know, there's so much in Office 365 because it's huge. I mean, you have Exchange Online, you have SharePoint, you have Link. Mm-hmm. And so what we wanted to do is first understand the technology and be a certified expert on the product so that we could articulate to our clients how the product works, what the great features are, how to use certain things. So we identified, you know, the basic applications that people use, Word, Excel, Outlook, PowerPoint, and then we started, you know, looking at some of the other applications. Since we were coming from Office 2007 background, we started looking at OneNote and selling OneNote. Then we started looking at Link and seeing what the capabilities are around Link. And so what we started seeing based off of our pilot group was that people were really gravitating towards Link. I mean, everybody really liked the integration within Outlook to do Link meetings, join your meeting online, even, you know, your pop-ups that actually give you that message to say join Link online meeting. So there was a huge push for us to actually focus in on Link, and that's what our strategy is. We're delivering Link as the first piece, and then we're going to be following that up with the entire Office bits.
Sure, and you've done some interesting stuff in terms of the user provisioning, in terms of getting users into the pool and then provisioning them services as well. How did you manage that?
So what we ended up doing is we stood up an Active Directory Federation server. Mm-hmm. We created a PowerShell script to automate DirSync. Mm-hmm. And one of our areas that was unique is, and for those customers out there who may have this problem, we don't own externally our domain, our internal domain. So what we needed to do is change user principal names within that PowerShell script to make sure that it was pointing to our correct externally owned domain.
Right, right. So how did we change the product then, Jefferson, in terms of making it so it wasn't just a download and install from the web type of technology?
Mm-hmm. So that is the default, what happens with Click to Run. Like, by default, it will download from the web. By default, it will get the latest bits and stay up to date. Of course, that won't fit for all of our customers' environments. For compliance reasons or testing reasons, they may want to not install from the internet, but instead use our tool to prepare an installation source, which they can host on some network share somewhere, or maybe they can install from there and ghost out their PC images. And so there's that flexibility. They also have the opportunity to decide which build they are on. We release new builds of Office monthly, aligned with Patch Tuesday. And of course, we want everybody on the latest bits. But if there's some reason, if they need more compliance testing for whatever reason, they can easily decide to stay back to whichever build best meets their needs.
Right. So we talked about patch management a bit, and you do have control over your patching and how that works. I wanted to go to Patrick and have you show us what you're doing in terms of this new world versus using, say, the MSP files and WSUS and what people are used to really live in this new click-to-run world and software servicing.
Sure.
Why don't you go ahead and show us on the PPI?
Give you a hand.
All right. Thanks, guy. So we actually had a DFS structure in place. We were kind of going through with the Microsoft consultant who was on premise for this to hold deployment. We looked at going kind of the traditional SCCM type of deployment and realized you know, DFS was just a simpler solution for what we were trying to do. So as a result, we had this DFS share. And we had a beta group. So every Tuesday when that new version comes out, we download it, copy those files in, and then the registry key points them to that directory so that those users then end up just pulling those new bits, that dog food group, if you will.
So that's for your test group of users?
Right.
They were pointing at that share right. for so, the updates?
Right, so this guy right here just ends up being that. And then once, you know, a week or two goes by and everybody says, okay, haven't had any problems, we end up just copy those same files to this larger share of people. And then that group actually, about 2 o'clock every night, it's just because it's a DFS replication share, mm-hmm. gets out to, we have roughly 150 to 200 job sites at any given time, all over the country, actually across borders as well, and then roughly about a dozen regional offices. So,
and then that DFS share is replicated out to all those sites?
Yep, just automatically. So and there's no real impact on bandwidth because it's happening after hours.
And is that for your actual users?
That would be the overall population, right.
That are pointing at that share for it. Gotcha.
Right, yeah, so that's just 12 regional offices and 150 job sites that goes out to. And just it just happens.
And what do the users need to do every morning when they come in to check for those?
So they'll get a little prompt, just sits up in the system tray, pops up and says you have new updates available, and you have the option to kind of cancel out of it or go in through and run it. You will have to close out the applications, or if they're like a lot of normal users. I mean, I think most people maybe leave their computer running during the week, but during the weekend, do a restart, they'll come in and they'll get that.
It'll run asynchronously as well.
Right.
Task.
While you guys are up there, we're getting a question coming in. What's the bandwidth requirement for all this? Because a lot of people are concerned they can't stream their Office clients down. What's that actually consuming on a network install versus the MSI?
You're saying to use Office?
To use just the clients, yeah.
Well, in terms of updating them, obviously, there's a different story. In order to use the clients on a daily basis, there's no bandwidth considerations.
Right.
You could have your PC offline and you would use whatever version is there. It raises an interesting point, however, about the bandwidth requirements of this kind of model that we're seeing implemented with a click-to-run install versus what you would have to do to patch your MSI mm-hmm. installs. Because those, if you took the difference between, you know, whatever version was sitting here and whatever version was sitting there. So say I was sitting on the one version, I come in the morning and I get the new version streamed down to me. That's all happening at a bit level delta change download. Unlike the traditional MSP type patch install, where those patches might actually have a number of different mm-hmm. Cumulative updates in them because we don't know what state that Office install was going to be at when we install that patch. Mm-hmm. So the overall bandwidth requirement would be less with a click-to-run install.
So it's about the same. I mean, the kind of the net result is it's about the same to get the initial install. The servicing kind of depends on how you're doing things. Now, by the way, there's probably been about 400 megs or so of patches since we RTM the MSIs. So by the time you deliver all of that stuff out, it still consumes a fair bit of bandwidth to even service it in that model, but about the same is usually the answer. So one thing that I'm hearing also is kind of like you guys are all seem to be using SCCM to deploy your Office click-to-run packages, so it does work with software distribution. So we wanted to actually show a demonstration of that, Yoni.
Yeah.
And kind of show what the SCCM System Center Configuration Manager experience looks like. Because at the end of the day, we're just basically distributing a setup.exe and a payload out to our machines, just like with the MSI.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't we take a look at what happens there? So what we've got here is our SCCM 2012 server, and I'm just going to create my Office 365 Pro Plus package. I'm using package mode here. I could use the app model, but that's a whole another discussion, isn't it, Jeremy?
You can use either or, whatever
you can. They both work. There's a couple of considerations with each one because if we use the app model, we need to cache.
It's always going to go down to CCM cache.
Right, which means it might be appropriate for initial installs, but probably maybe not for updates because if we were
re-pushing this setup.exe to do subsequent updates, we'd be downloading the whole package every time rather than just the deltas.
Sure. Or you can point it to an update path on a network share, which...
That wasn't inside yet, yeah.
Like Patrick's doing.
And look, I guess the point that I keep trying to get across is that it's all about flexibility. You've got all those different options there. Patrick is using DFS, and that works quite nicely. We can see I just pushed this out now to my All Desktops collection. But yeah, in some cases, DFS is going to make sense. Some organizations might have really mature SCCM environments with a whole stack of distribution points like this one that I have on my demo server here, and might want to leverage that infrastructure that they already have to distribute. So in those cases, it might make sense to use package mode inside SCCM and select the option that says to run from the distribution point. And then that way we can take advantage of distributing the bits out to our SCCM distribution points. I just jump over onto my client now, and you can see what happens. We've advertised this package out, and I can kick off the install. And we can see that what it's actually going to do in this case is download the whole install into our CCM cache, and then install it from the local location. So like I said, all about flexibility. If one scenario would work in one case that wouldn't work very well in another, and it all just depends how many sites you have to deal with, how many PCs, where those PCs are placed, all these considerations. But I'm really happy that there is a solution there to meet each one. So we can see that about 90 seconds, 2 minutes after we kicked off that install, we've now got a working version of Office on the computer. I can load up Word and start to use it straight from there. And in this case, we're still caching some of the bits locally onto the machine, but within the space of 2 minutes, I've got that working Office environment right there on the machine.
Right. So any tool, Intune, System Center Configuration Manager, third parties, even Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. We showed that in the last episode. All these things, as long as they can run that setup.exe and a few command line switches, they will all deploy the new Office.
So, and Jeremy, we're going to obviously go into a lot more detail about configuration management exactly. In general, how to work with the bootstrapper, the setup.exe, and also how to integrate in with different tools, MDT, SCCM, like you were saying, over the next 3 episodes. So you guys should definitely tune in and check those out.
Right, so we're going to change gears a bit. We've actually got a bit of a treat in store. We're going to, as is tradition, we're going to show trivia. And we've got a different flair on this. So we're going to basically get everybody on separate couches. We're going to do an east versus west thing. Okay, so Paul, you're now on the East Coast couch with John and Patrick.
You guys are
You're all still set. East Coast even though you're from the UK, and Sebastian is on the West Coast because you live in the West Coast even though you're German.
Yeah.
And Marvin and Jefferson. Now we're going to see who knows the most about the Office 365 service. We're going to go a little bit higher level on the questions, get a little bit deeper into the technology as we go on. So,
now, of course, the guys have got their buzzers there.
Everybody's got a buzzer in their hand. We've got our judges queued up. So let's do the first question. Yep.
True or false? Organizations with software assurance for Office can use Office 365 Pro Plus at no additional cost.
So it looks like the East Couch.
That would be true.
It is no additional cost. If you have software assurance, you can move to the online Office 365 Pro Plus, and you can even move back if you don't like it, even though you never would want to do that, right, Paul?
Exactly.
So you can
certainly
move back
have the
and
capability
forth.
To do it's that.
It's a virtual capability.
Yes, right. That's right.
So that was an easy question. Now we're going to go on to question 2, where we're going to a little bit harder. So go ahead.
True or false? Outlook in Office 365 Pro Plus can be installed side by side with older versions of Outlook.
West Coast.
That would be the West Coast.
It is true. It can be installed side by side. Outlook's a little bit tricky, kind of. The Windows file system lets you have one handle open to that data file, the OST. So you can only have one version open at a time.
But they can be installed side by side.
But they can be installed side by side.
Which, was. Yeah.
Which, by the way, helps when you're doing the piloting and people need to transition from one to the other, whether it's user interface.
Piloting like in a like.
Well, and that wasn't always the case, right? Older versions of Office, you couldn't do that. Locally installed versions of Office.
And Outlook, especially, yes. It actually removed the older ones. So that wasn't even the case when you tried to do it in MSI. So let's go to the next.
Piloting, like, as in.
Piloting the software.
Pilot groups rather than like what
True or false? Office 365 Pro Plus uses more bandwidth than the MSI version when installed in a private network.
East Coast.
False.
False.
Network bandwidth or internet bandwidth?
Yes.
Sorry, Sega?
We're talking about network bandwidth or internet? No, sorry, it was a gotcha.
So the main thing was, like we mentioned earlier, it's using about the same bandwidth. I mean, it is the Office Mondo package, as we call it, kind of in pre-release time frame, where it's got a few more things, but it's roughly a gig either way, so it's pretty much the same. All right, next question.
True or false? Office 365 Pro Plus may be installed from a DVD.
Ooh.
West Coast.
We say false.
You say false. Go on, elaborate.
Yeah, tell us why.
You elaborate.
You've got them right.
Let's
where
see.
We
so with Office 365 Pro Plus, the end users, they can go to their portal and install it from themselves if the IT administrators allow that. Also, as we discussed with SCCM and whatnot, the administrators can use the Office deployment tool, prepare their own source, put it on a network share,
or a DVD.
Or a DVD or a USB stick. Point to that as your source path.
What's it true?
So we'll give the point to John, actually. You can install
Office
from a DVD.
365 is too flexible for this not to be true.
Exactly. All right, next question.
True or false? Office applications delivered using application virtualization, aka streaming, actually run completely from the local hard drive.
East Coast.
True. It does run locally, so you don't have to be online.
Everything's running locally, yes. If you're using the click-to-run implementation or download and execute with AppV, even AppV version 5, it's running from the local hard drive. Next question.
True or false? The default file save location in Office 2013 is the user's local documents library.
East Coast.
False. It actually goes, I believe, to SkyDrive first, unless you set it by group policy to be otherwise.
Okay, so we've got one more question as part of this. Go ahead.
That was correct, by the way, right?
That was correct, yes.
Leave me hanging.
This property in the Office Deployment Tools configuration XML file determines where updates are installed from.
True.
That was my question.
West Coast. The update path?
The update path is correct.
We need the full syntax there, Jeff.
No, it's okay.
Update element, update path.
No, absolutely, that's correct. The update path option in the configuration file is where you would set whether you want the updates to come from a local path or from the content delivery network.
Right, so that's almost all we have time for today. We've got a lot, though, coming up in the next couple of episodes of the Garage series every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific. We're going to be covering a three-part episode about deployment and doing a lot more extreme installs. I know your favorite one's coming up.
Right, next week, I believe, we have my favorite extreme install of the whole series coming up, so looking forward to that.
Yeah, so we're going to do that. We're going to do a lot more depth. We're going to do virtualization towards...
Yeah, absolutely. We've got some more engineers to talk with. We've got, like you said, the three-part on configuration management. We go into SCCM, MDT. Mm-hmm. We do a bit more on localization, multi-language. I know a topic very close to your heart, Jeremy.
Right. And let's go to a clip as to what's coming up in the next couple of weeks.
The fact that click to run was automatable, it could be uninstalled in seconds, you could move to a fresh build to test your changes, all of that drove a change in user behavior on the engineers actually building the Office product.
Intune is loading down the software, come on! It's almost there. I want to see apps in my Metro start screen. Sorry, I meant to say start screen, not Metro.
All right, so that's basically all that we have time for today. I want to make sure I thank Paul Thurrett and all of our guests that were with us today. Thank you so much for coming here.
Of course, all the resources from today's live show and all the previous and future episodes, you can get them on our blog, microsoft.com/garage.
And one factoid is we actually redirect that link. Sorry, I had to do an inside joke there, nice. Paul. We actually redirect that link every week to the latest post, and we also have an archive link that you can catch up on all the past episodes, and if you catch us later, you can look at all of the ones in the season up until now.
So down the bottom of each post, we have that link to the archive, and like you say, that has all the previous episodes, because I've been getting that question a few times lately as well.
Right, so we're excited about what's to come, and we thank you for joining today, and we'll see you next week.